So welcome to episode 17 of the Amphrozoology podcast. My name is Chris Hill, and I'm doing a PhD with Exeter University looking at cat-human relations and discourses surrounding free-roaming cats.
Hi, my name's Sarah Oxley-Heaney. I'm a PGR with the University of Exeter, and I'm looking at shark-human interactions.
Hi, I'm Michelle Sidlowski, and I have my PhD in anthrozoology, and I focus on the interplay between humans and animals that are the focus of conservation, especially endangered species like Asian elephants. Today's guest is our very own Dr. Christine Hill. Dr. Hill received her first PhD in plant molecular biology, but decided to change careers and is currently pursuing her PhD in anthrozoology. This move was predicated by a desire to refocus on research that felt more meaningful and a lifelong affinity with other than human animals. Today, we're discussing her paper entitled Tattoo Narratives, Insights into Multi-Species Kinship and Grief Work, which was her debut paper as an anthrozoologist. Thanks for switching roles today from co-host to guest, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for that introduction, Michelle. Yes, I'm really, really happy to talk about this subject, namely animal-themed tattoo narratives, and in particular, those associated with companion animals. So basically, I listened to participants in this study talk about their tattoos, which could have either been a piece dedicated to an individual they knew personally, or a design that embodied a species. And we're going to talk about the first part today, I think. So I wrote it up as my MA thesis, and subsequently published in Amphrozoos. And this project is dear to my heart because it represents, firstly, my debut as an anthrozoologist. This is my first anthrozoology paper, and it's tied up to a couple of key life events. So firstly, in 2016, I was facing an uncertain an uninspired future, and I was searching for actually a more career development type course when I stumbled on the Amphrozoology MA at Exeter. And I came back to it a couple of times, and I was like, if I could start over again, this is what I would study. And here I am.
So could you tell us about the project in a nutshell, please, Chris?
Oh, in a nutshell. Yeah, I can be concise. So in a nutshell, I performed a thematic discourse analysis of tattoo narratives. So essentially, I looked at how participants related to their tattoos, so how they talked about them and the meanings they constructed around the designs. And for the whole project, I interviewed 24 participants. And I had three research questions, but the latter two are focused on the paper we're talking about today, which is those who had tattoos dedicated to a companion animal, so an individual they knew personally. And the key research questions I asked were, are tattoos dedicated to companion animals indicative of kinship? And what role do memorial tattoos play in the grieving process and adjustment to loss?
Well, I think a good place to start then would be asking the answer to that question, are tattoos dedicated to companion animals indicative of kinship? What did you find out about kinship? And can you sort of explain that a little bit for our listeners?
So I examined narratives associated with companion animal tattoos under the framework of nurture kinship and the theory of kinship as mutuality of being. As well as the role of memorial tattoos in grief work and this theory of continuing bonds. And I actually concluded that humans can and do form kinship bonds with other animals, and also that memorial tattoos can serve similar functions regardless of the species of the deceased loved one.
So you said your research on companion animal tattoos concluded that companion animals are family members. So why then do you think they're so often relinquished?
So I think the key word in my conclusion is can and do. So I think it's important to note that I don't think companion animals are always family, even when people say or even believe they are. So why are they often relinquished? Because I think that in most cases they aren't really family members. And so Shervestra in 2012 in her paper wrote about this notion of companion animals as being flexible persons or emotional commodities that could at any moment be demoted from family status and rehomed. And I think this may be a case for a lot of people who bring companion animals into their home. But I think sometimes there are these strong bonds that I believe are kinship bonds. But I also believe that the act of immortalizing a person on your arm suggests a deeper connection, which is backed up by the narratives in my study. So you wouldn't necessarily get, if somebody that you weren't close to passed away, you wouldn't necessarily get their image immortalized. So if not a kinship bond, it's indicative of a deep connection.
Do you feel it's almost as if a tattoo is immortalized on a body, that means that companion animal can no longer be a flexible person or has no chance to be a flexible person? Although I guess tattoos could be remarked over, etc. What are your feelings on that?
Yeah, I was actually reflecting on that the other day again. I mean, I would actually love to interview people that had sort of regretted a tattoo. But I mean, I couldn't imagine sort of having somebody immortalized on my arm that I knew I was going to rehome. That would be a constant reminder as your sort of failure as a companion animal guardian to have this dog that you sort of rehomed because, I do recognize that some people are sort of forced to relinquish. It's not always, and then it would become more like a memorial tattoo. You would actually sort of feel the grief over losing them. But I don't know, I kind of wonder how many people have tattoos sort of spur of the moment, didn't really think about it, like, I've got this new dog, I love him, I'm going to get my tattoo of him, and then something happens and they rehome them. And but I think my participants, they sort of came forward, they wanted to talk about that tattoo, and maybe if it was a mistake you wouldn't want to talk about it. And I mean, I guess I would like it to the sort of sort of partner tattoos where you have like I love Susie on your arm and then you break up and it's like everybody says don't get your significant other tattooed, and some tattoo artists won't even do those sort of tattoos, whereas if you have sort of your mother like I love mum tattoos, that would be indicative of a kinship bond, right? It's a lasting bond.
Also, I was interested in your you mentioned how you define family, because could you go into that a little bit, please, about the different kinship relationships? Because family means different things to different people. Mm-hmm. So what did it mean to you, family and kin, in this study?
So the sort of traditional way that anthropologists would describe it, they had the three types, the blood relatives, so your the people you gave birth to, the people you're related to genetically, marriage, family, so the people that you're married to, your in-laws, your husband, your wife, and then this other thing called fictive kin, and there's sort of that word's not very well liked. It's sort of the other group, and in Western society, that's like, godparents or adoptive children. And the problem there is it makes it seem sort of less than the, and it is very problematic. And I think it was Weston argued in her book Families We Choose that the term fictive it adds to stigmatization because it suggests that they're not real relationships, so it sort of demeans the child-parent relationship in cases of adoption or stepchildren relations. And there's actually not a better term that's I've sort of come across. Contemporary anthropologists, they generally think of kinship as being culturally defined. And the essential thing seems to be that members of a family consider each other family, So this is kind of the constructionist position. And the basis for this sort of, I guess it's not that new now, but the idea of new kinship studies, which addresses kinship in the context of relationships that involve adoption and a non, they're not produced biologically, basically. I think it was Nelson that points out that there's not really been a good alternative word, but perhaps families we choose. So this actually came up, one of my participants sort of described them as her family by choice. Basically, a family member is somebody that you treat as family. So the actual act of treating someone as family makes them family, which of course opens up more questions about exactly what. And so I sort of built on this Charlin's idea of mutuality of being, which he claims underpins all forms of kinship. So basically this idea of conjoined existence, and so you live together and you take on your kin's, you sort of celebrate in their successes and joys, but you also, you're stuck with their lesser. So basically they're not somebody that you consider kin, you don't necessarily have to like, and you can think, this isn't somebody I choose as a friend, but they're my mother and I'm stuck with them. So it's that. that kind of idea. And it doesn't need to be biological. It's sort of more a state of being. And I really liked Holland's concept of nurture kinship. So it basically describes how these kinships are sort of, they're born through nurture. So, and basically this means that the parent-child bond is the same regardless of whether that came about through reproduction or otherwise. So an adoptive child is still, that bond is still there and it's propagated through nurture, whereas maybe a biological parent who gave up their child would not have, they wouldn't have that kinship bond.
My actual animals are my, and then I was thinking, well, what word do I actually use? They're the people I choose to have this relationship with, but family might not be right, kin might not be right, etc. Anyway, yeah, you've got my
uses. Yeah, and going back, so this is sort of jumping forward to my PhD research now, and one of my the case studies that I interviewed, she talks about the relationship with her two cats, and she has sort of a bit of a rocky relationship with the one cat. Like she doesn't like the prey he brings home, and she sort of describes this troubled relationship, but she uses the phrase like, but he's with us for better or worse. And you can sort of feel the love she feels towards this cat, even though she doesn't like when he brings dead things home. And I think that would be a good example of kinship one, because you're kind of, you can feel not everybody loves their companion animals. And I think it was one of our previous podcasts, Hal Herzog talked about he'd love to study people who didn't like their companion animals. And
I think he worded it as he would really like to study people who think their dogs are assholes.
Yeah.
And I think that would be a great title for a paper. I think that too, sometimes, I think it depends on the person, because you have family members that you don't necessarily like, that you put up with at family get-togethers, and you still sometimes communicate with them. But you also have other human family members that you completely cut off for your own mental health. And I think that is the exact same thing we see with our companion species, our chosen family members. Some people are very good at understanding that relationship is forever, even if you're not getting along with your companions, whereas other people do see them as flexible persons, whereas once you stop getting along, that person is out the door. So I think it's very much reflective of our relationships with our own human blood relations
and our friends. And it makes me think of where do we sometimes forgive our friends more than our family, because we can have more of a conversation sorry, we're talking about humans now, but we can maybe have talk it out more with a human friend rather than a human family member, because it's going to create too much angst, possibly. I don't know.
I think there's the choice involved too. You have chosen your friends, and that's why I think you'll give them a little more leeway, much as we have chosen the other species that we share our life with. So maybe we'll give them a little more leeway than we would the family that we're born into and sort of feel stuck with sometimes.
Yeah, sort of carrying on from that though, I don't know. I mean, like you, I mean, you could say you choose your adoptive son, but once that choice is made, it's sort of, it's a permanent choice. And yeah, I don't know. So, I mean, yeah, like you were saying with the companion animals, you made that choice to bring them into your home. And I think if you feel a genuine kinship bond, you feel committed. And it's like, even if they're a pain in the butt, you're committed. And I think that differentiates from maybe a sort of a close friend. Whereas if a friend gets too much, you will say like, yeah, enough, I'm cutting you. But then of course you can do that with family too. It's like, what is family? I don't know.
I think we also don't feel the same sense of betrayal from our chosen kin of other species, in that, you know, humans have a very large potential to betray one another. And I don't think that your odds of being severely betrayed by your, you know, the dog who you share your life with is quite as high as being betrayed by the humans in your life. But I do want to go back to your memorial tattoo idea, in that I think part of the reason memorial tattoos are more permanent, or are more, I don't want to say acceptable, but make more sense to me, is that once that person has passed, they are no longer changing. They're no longer
transgressing. You know,
yeah, misbehaving or trespassing on your space, or right. So when you choose to do a memorial tattoo, you're not going to run. It's like with the relationship. So you break up with that person, you want to get the tattoo covered over. It's different if that person has passed. You know, they're no longer able to have a fight with you. And I think that that's part of the reason that there's that stronger sense of connection.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I know from my own, and this is something speaking to my participants or part of the other project, sort of, they say, you know, one day I'll get a tattoo for my dog. I definitely will. And I sort of had the same feeling. My cats were a sort of big part of my life. I like knew for many years I was going to get something to represent them. I just didn't really know what. And that's something that, yeah, my participants also said, but then like after they passed, it felt right. And I don't know, one thing I think would be interesting. So sadly, two of my participants, they had tattoos sort of while their companion was still alive. And I sort of know now that they've passed on. And I'm curious how the sort of relationship to their tattoo changed. Because yeah, I think that continuing bonds that I mentioned in the paper is sort of, yeah, really important. And it's something that I experienced firsthand now since my cats died, and I have sort of something that I can connect to.
I was thinking about, so this permanent bond is then created upon human skin, that the kinship bond is as a permanent, is immortalized on human skin. Did you speak to anybody about how they then want their own bodies, what they want to happen to their own skin after they are deceased, in terms of, like, you wrote in your other paper about the 5,000 year old tattoo that was found on human skin. And it just made me think, if people have thought beyond their own death and how long they want that actual memorialization and bond to continue in choosing how they then, whether they're buried or cremated.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. I can't remember if it was in the paper or not now, but one of my participants, we did sort of talk about sort of grief and memorialization in general, and as well as the tattoo. She had her cat's ashes in a little urn. And her plan was to be buried with him eventually. So she wanted her ashes to be combined with his. And interestingly, she also sort of reflected on this a little bit. And she's like, oh, I don't know what I'd do with the cats I have now. Because she feels the sort of the same, well, she said she felt the same way. And I guess they could all be together. But yeah, I thought that was kind of nice, the idea of keeping the ashes with the idea that you'd be combined.
Yeah.
But then, of course, yeah, if you're going to be sort of cremated, then the tattoo's not going to stay. But yeah, no, that would be, yeah, in like a few thousand years of some of what future anthropologists would make of.
Exactly. And yeah, that's what I don't know if you guys do either, but sometimes I often think what we leave behind now, if our civilization fails, what message would that give by finding little pieces of whatever? And yeah, so I wondered if anybody had thought that they wanted to carry on this bond as long, or the memory of this bond as long as they possibly could by doing other things, which maybe digitally is, that could all disappear, but actual flesh that could be rediscovered would be possibly more permanent. Anyway,
it does seem like a tattoo is about the most permanent thing we as humans can do. There isn't a lot else that will last throughout, you know, your entire life. So, yeah, I mean, short of getting it marked on your bones so that if your bones get found, there are very few more permanent ways. I did want to ask a question about this loss, this memorialization in tattoos. Do you find that your participants wanted to get a tattoo to sort of reinforce the logic and the acceptability of grieving for their pet? Was this a way, because society, I know when I've lost my companion animals, there have been a lot of, oh, it was just a dog, or oh, it was just this. And there's no just for people who've actually made kinship bonds with animals. So we talk a lot about this disenfranchised grief, that we're not allowed to grieve for a non-human family. So can you talk a little bit about how your participants felt about this, having a tattoo sort of reinforcing the acceptability of mourning a non-human kin?
Yeah, I didn't really get a sense that they were doing anything consciously to make it accepted. It was more they were doing it for themselves, but I think indirectly it had a positive effect. And there was one example, she talks about her mother doesn't approve of tattoos at all. She hasn't approved of any of her previous designs, but she said nothing about the memorial tattoos. It's almost like the tattoos were speaking that, yeah, this is important. And her mother was able to recognize the significance. And another participant, she said that she had a couple of comments like, oh, that's a stupid idea for a tattoo. Why would you do that? But this big bold tattoo, it sort of basically is like in your face, and she sort of talks about a lot wanting to sort of embody the personality of this cat, who was very sort of bossy and sort of extrovert, and like and she felt that it was the tattoo also was a way to that she'd always be part of her. So it's not just honoring this cat, who was sort of a big part of her childhood, actually. There was a couple of participants who had bonds that were formed in childhood and went through to young adulthood. So yeah, and I think that, and actually another interesting thing is sort of not in the, this is more anecdotal. I can never say that word, sorry, anecdotal. If you look online and sort of talk to people, a lot of people are having their first tattoos, companion animal tattoos or pet tattoos. If you go online, there's a lot of sort of, middle-aged or older men and women. The women tend to talk about it more, but there are men that are getting memorial tattoos to their deceased companion animals. So it's sort of this new basically individuals you wouldn't necessarily associate with tattoo culture. So some of my participants, this wasn't their first tattoo, others it was. And yeah, it just seems to be a way of really sort of asserting that the loss matters, and then it's a way that they have a talking point if they want to talk, and it's sort of something that's always with them. I mean, there's a lot more to research and unpack there, I think.
And this idea of body signage really intrigued me, because and you also wrote about something else about people. Sometimes people would cover up their tattoos, and then in other occasions they would have them exposed, so that almost inviting conversation. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me that participants seem to be comfortable to talk about tattoos, their own personal tattoos, in some circumstances, and not in others. And there were different places in the body. I was wondering, I was thinking this would be really interesting. Well, there's so many interesting papers that could come out of this, but it made me think of people that didn't know the individual with tattoos. A, how comfortable the person who was intrigued were in asking about tattoos, and B, how comfortable the person with the tattoo is comfortable with somebody they don't know asking about a personal tattoo. I thought those two, because I mean, we all see people with tattoos, and sometimes you can see one that really catches your eye, but I don't feel it's my personal, it doesn't feel comfortable in the situations I've been, unless I'm sitting down, I mean, perhaps at a social event, saying, would you mind telling me about that tattoo? It seems it's there as signage, but there seems to still be a boundary of how much you're allowed to ask about it. And it'd be interesting to know, did the participants talk about that at all, how comfortable they were with being asked about their tattoos?
Yeah, most of them seemed to be like they really enjoyed sort of having them pointed out, because they gave them an opportunity to sort of talk about the subject of their tattoo. The one participant who has the black cat tattoos, she says over the years she's grown less and less, she's become more and more reluctant to sort of talk, and now she'll only talk if pushed, like if somebody says, oh, I like your tattoo, she'll say thank you. And she doesn't really, or she says she didn't really know why that was. The tattoo still has that very personal meaning. It's like she doesn't want to talk. And I mean, they're very visible, and yeah, they're beautiful tattoos. I kind of see the same now. Whenever I see someone with an animal themed tattoo, I want to go up and ask some questions. And I think if you sort of say, if you just compliment someone and they'll use that as an opener, and they'll either say sort of, yeah, thank you, or they'll sort of talk more. I was just going to say they are conversation openers, and maybe, yeah, and I guess with the example with the black cat tattoos, it was intended as a conversation opener maybe in the beginning, but it is less so now, so sort of your relationship with your tattoos, like it changes over time. And Margot de Mello talks about that sort of in the book based on her PhD thesis, about how sort of narrative change over time. So the meaning that you originally assigned to your tattoo when you got it done 10 years ago may not be the one that you've constructed now, which I find is interesting. My interviews were all done at one point in time. It's...
Because you make me think about myself, why I don't have a tattoo. And one is because I thought, well, I changed my mind quite a lot. So if I had, well, first of all, I don't know if I'd like it. And then I would probably be obsessing over it. Number two, I would think, well, maybe I'd change my mind about it. But now you make me think, or this conversation has made me think, is it because I don't want to invite conversation about something that's very personal to my own life? And that's got me intrigued, actually. I don't know if that is the answer, but it's kind of a third thing I hadn't thought about before.
It might be. So this idea of embodied storytelling, and sort of I compared a lot of my discourses from the study to Deborah Davison's work. So she looked at memorial tattoos in humans through this idea of embodied storytelling, and how they sort of really helped maintain that absent presence. So the person was always in the room, and it sort of helped. It basically helped sort of talking about the deceased in a therapeutic sort of way. It was something healthy. But yeah, I mean, it's what if you suddenly don't want to talk about it? It's like, I guess you can wear long sleeves. But yeah. But then there's also the sort of personal aspect where it's some. So with my own tattoos, I feel I had totally different experience when Sophie died. I had a tattoo and I really sort of felt I wanted to talk about her. It was sort of therapeutic. I wrote a blog for the ISIS blog, and I could really relate to my participants, and I wanted to show off a tattoo. But then when Yoda died, it was a lot more personal, and it's like I don't really want to talk about it as much, so I don't really talk about I'm talking about it now, of course, but I talk less about Sophie. But I talk to them, I talk to my tattoos sometimes, or I just sort of think, and so I still relate to them, but I'm less wanting to share them now.
I think it depends where you put the tattoo also. So if you have a tattoo, say on your forearm, mm-hmm. I think in a lot of ways you're expressing that you might want to converse about that tattoo. Whereas if you have a tattoo that you've placed somewhere that's generally covered by clothing, I think that's a little more, you know, personal, want to keep it closer to the heart, don't necessarily want to discuss it as much. So I'm curious as to where your tattoo for Sophie is compared to where your tattoo for Yoda is.
Yeah, and I didn't actually think about that at all when I knew instantly where I wanted. Sophie's tattoo is on my right forearm, and it's where she laid down it's where she went to sleep for the final time. And it just felt right. And then Sophie is on my other inner arm. So it is more, they're visible with short sleeves, and I like them because I can see them, like they were part of my life for 16 years, and that'll always sort of be part of my identity. So when I say I don't like to talk about them, it's not like it's just I'm not so open, and sort of if somebody says, oh, I like your tattoo, I don't go on and on anymore, whereas I did a little bit with my Sophie tattoo, and I kind of wonder if maybe I will be like that participant I mentioned with her black cat tattoos, whether she just, I mean, now she says she just says thank you if somebody says anything, and she tries not to talk about it.
So it's part of grief work. It's part of the grieving process then.
Yeah, and I think everybody's journey is different. And I mean, you can, if somebody sort of says, it's not necessarily, well, actually, this does go back to the design. Some designs are clearly a memorial tattoo if you have sort of the year of birth and stuff. Others, it could just be a nice cat design. And you can just say, oh, I like cats. I don't think people actually think about that so much with me. Again, this is something that could really be researched more from not just from the companion animals, but also human.
I think there's almost, you know, we talk about that the disenfranchised grief, and that we're not allowed to grieve so much for our companions that aren't human. But I wonder too if it isn't easier almost to talk about, like if I see a memorial tattoo to a person, I think I am less likely to ask, you know, and if I say, what is this for? Mm-hmm. And they say, oh, my sister died, I think I'm a lot less likely to sort of unpack that story. But maybe that's just because I'm definitely more aimed at other than human animals as opposed to human animals. But if somebody tells me, oh, it's a memorial tattoo for my cat or my dog, I'm definitely going to ask them, you know, mm-hmm. what happened, and you know, what's the story. Whereas maybe I don't necessarily want to hear about the sad story surrounding their loss of a human kin.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And I actually don't really know if there's been really any research at all, nothing that I'm aware of where you sort of go at the other side, sort of how your tattoos are affecting people around you. Like, But yeah, so I go back to the continuing bonds thing. And one thing that I really wanted to bring up, which also, so I basically concluded that the the memorial tattoos, they function the same whether they were in honor of a human or a companion animal. They sort of had the same, they function the same. And one area, so one of my participants, she talked about the tattoo she has of a paw print of her dog. And she shared that she had a history of self-harming, and now she says sometimes she'll touch her hip where the tattoo is as sort of a reminder that her dog will be sad, that this was a dog that from her childhood, and he died in early adulthood, so he was sort of a big part of her life, and she still has that bond now. She'll still sort of touch and think, yeah, Boo doesn't. Okay, I say Boo, that's not, I anonymized both the human and the companion animal names. And I can't actually remember their actual real names now. It's sort of so much in my head. But that's something that Deborah Davidson's research also sort of came up. There was an example, I think it was a young woman who had a tattoo honoring her father. And she said that also sometimes, she also had a history of self-harm, and she would touch the tattoo and that would sort of give her strength. That was a connection to her father who wouldn't want her to do that.
Well, I wanted to ask but you obviously don't answer if you don't want to, Michelle. Michelle, do you have any tattoos, any animal?
I do not have any tattoos. And I actually, when my older daughter got her first tattoo, she got something very representative to her that it was dolphin related. And when she got her second tattoo, I told her I would get a matching tattoo because sea turtles are sort of our bond. And she was actually feeling very lonely one time, and she was in the ocean, and she said a sea turtle swam by, and she, I had very emotional talking about it. And she knew that sea turtle represented my presence with her, right? So she has a tattoo of a sea turtle, and I said I would get a matching one on my foot, and it's been 12 years and I have yet to get the matching tattoo because I am a little bit afraid of, I'm afraid of it itching. That's what I'm afraid of. But I would, and if I did get one, it would be the matching turtle. And then of course I would probably, something I wanted to ask you about actually, was that people would assume I would get a tattoo of an elephant, right? Because I work so closely with elephants. They've been such a big part of my life. And I considered that, but then I thought I might find it actually triggering because the elephants that I work with are not necessarily in the best places for them. And so when someone gives me an elephant necklace or an elephant toy, it actually brings in a little bit of sadness. And so I think I would have difficulty having an elephant tattoo because it would remind me of the changes I'm trying to support and encourage, and even a little bit of not being able to do that. So yeah. Do you have any tattoos, Sarah?
No, I don't have any. I don't want, it's interesting. This conversation made me think, I guess I only want to talk about the animals that are important to me or have been important to me when I decide that that's when I want to share it. And that's because one of them particularly, I still can't talk about, and that's been years. So, but it's interesting. I hadn't thought about that would have been a reason why before at all. Yeah, I did see this lady once. She was on the TV years ago. She had a beautiful coloured bee, and it spread across her whole chest. She was very young. It was brilliant colours. It looked fantastic, and it looked fantastic on her. But I did think, how's that going to look when you're older? You can't change that. It's going to be really difficult to change or to hide or to. So I don't know why having the ability to change is like, you can change your makeup, you can change your clothes. I think that you mentioned that actually, Chris, in your paper. You know, you can change your identity by doing other things, which is not permanent. So I don't know. I do wonder, and it'd be an interesting paper for the future, like in 20 years time, asking people how they feel about their animal themed tattoos now or their other tattoos. I think it would be very.
Well, I, I think something Chris mentioned earlier was that I think that the memorial tattoos are sort of outside of that sort of standard realm of tattooing, is that they're almost, you know, I think they appeal to a range of people that maybe would not have gotten a tattoo on a regular basis, but see this as a really permanent and good way to memorialize. So it's not necessarily something that appeals only to those that are interested in tattoos, but rather to a wider group of people.
But tattooing is now more socially acceptable. Therefore, people who are memorializing their companion animals might only do it now because it is more socially acceptable, and prior to that, they wouldn't.
I do think too, though, that those of us that have shared our lives with, other than human kin, you might run out of body space, especially if you work with other species as a researcher. Like if I had all of these memorial tattoos of, because we used to adopt in elderly dogs, right? And I know Sarah, you adopt in disabled animals. So there's a lot of loss. And I think that I would run out of body space if I did that. And I also wonder if it would get heavier and become less
special.
Yeah. Because if you've got the one or the two that were like your longest term companions, I wonder if that's somehow different than if I were to more memorialize, because I love them all, dearly and equally. But I think if I had them all on me, it would be less special for some reason.
But is that us as humans now categorizing things again? Because we always have to categorize the hierarchy of, it's interesting where our minds kind of take that over take over doing that sometimes, don't they?
So
do you ever have other tattoos then, Chris? Any other animal themed tattoos?
I guess most of them I have. I have my unicorn on my arm, which was my first, I call it my first proper tattoo. I had a stupid homemade one underneath that it covers it up. So my unicorn's like 25 years old now. I have a phoenix on my back and a ladybug on my ankle.
I have to ask, why a unicorn?
I used to say it was my favorite, and this is a good example that Margot de Mello was talking about in her book about how stories change. I used to say it was my favorite animal when I had it done in my 20s. And I've constructed different meanings over the years, but I like unicorns. And it really was more, I was in the tattoo shop and I am like, I like that. and like I said, I had this stupid homemade one that I wanted to get covered up, so I knew I wanted to design that. And
well, you know, the next question is going to be, what was the homemade tattoo?
It was actually just my initial. It was sort of with the Indian ink, sort of playing around as a teenager, and it just looked like somebody had scribbled in pen on my arm, and people would sometimes point it out, and it was embarrassing.
Do you have any relationship tattoos with your partner?
No, he doesn't have any tattoos at all. And I don't think I would ever have a spouse or one. I do know a couple of people who've had tattoos done to sort of signify their marriage, as sort of that extra commitment beyond the ring that they can take off. Some couples do that. But I don't know. It's like it's permanent, right?
Well, there's the famous case, contemporary case of Johnny Depp's Winona Forever. I don't know if you watched the trial. And then Amber allegedly was asking about why it said wino, because he'd covered it up allegedly with Winona Forever up with wino. So again, relationship changing. And it would be interesting to know if people did cover up their memorial or their companion animal. Sorry, what was the other term? Memorial and commemorative tattoos.
For lack of a better word, it was sort of the relationship tattoos.
With other than human animals. So it would be interesting to see if any of those have been covered up and why, and the stories behind that. And it's quite fascinating, really, isn't it?
Yeah, because the study, of course, is biased towards people that want to tell their story. It's not so easy to convince somebody who's embarrassed about their design or doesn't want to talk.
Yeah.
Did you have anyone, I guess, when you solicited participants, did you put out a call and participants contacted you, or did you approach anyone that you knew had a tattoo of an animal theme and said, hey, would you like to participate? Did you have anyone to decline?
No, I didn't actually approach anybody. It was more sort of come to me, and was probably in part how my ethics was wrote, and in part that I didn't feel comfortable approaching people, though. I mean, I saw this idea was sort of came about in part because there was a guy in my gym who had what was clearly a memorial tattoo with his dog. You could see the years and the image of the dog. And I really wanted to ask him about the tattoo, but I'm like, well, is that, did he want to talk about it? I don't know. I could have said I like your tattoo, but I never did, so.
That's the danger of social science, is that sometimes we have to suppress those instincts to ask someone their story because we aren't clear on whether or not they actually want to share that story.
And so one other thing that I did actually want to talk about. So as part of my thesis, my MA thesis, I haven't sort of published it. But one aspect of that was ambassador animal tattoos. And so I have a bit of data on that, and I would love to explore that more and sort of related to, so the idea of an ambassador animal tattoo, I had one participant who had various designs of owls, and they were actually individual owls that she'd sort of interacted with. And she uses tattoos as a talking point to sort of advocate for owls and basically tell people about owls. And there was another example with sort of bees too. And there was an art exhibition in, I forget what year now, it's sort of 15 years old now, X Inked. And that had that idea where they I think it was even 100 people volunteered to have a native British species tattooed on their body. And the idea was to promote that species. So like animal ambassador, I think that may have been the birth of the idea of this ambassador animal tattoo. But so like for you, Michelle, it would be you'd have a big visible elephant. And then that would be sort of an opener to talk about why we should care. And
which is actually a really less consumptive way of doing things. You know, when we talk about the need to have ambassador species at zoos or aquariums, or I mean, this is a much more kind and I guess environmentally just way of starting a conversation rather than having the actual living, breathing species there.
It reminds me of there was a group of people who actually tattooed a number on their body. I can't remember, they were animal activists, and it was about a calf that was going to be slaughtered or had been slaughtered. And it's like, it was representative, we are all this calf. And so they tattooed this number on them. I'll try and find that and put it in, put it in the comments, description. But that would be an ambassador. It wouldn't be a tattoo of an animal, but it would be in relation to an animal. So an ambassador tattoo for an other than human animal.
Activist tattoos, I see a lot of that on Twitter now. And I think that's sort of, it's getting a message out. And then again, a talking point, sort of somebody says, what is that? That's an eye tattoo on your arm. What does it mean? And it's sort of another way of opening dialogue.
Definitely. It's interesting. So what's next for your tattoo research then, Chris?
Well, nothing's planned yet, but this is definitely a subject that I would love to follow up on more. And I have a bunch of ideas that maybe I'll get to do as a postdoc. So I have a bunch of data from my thesis on tattoos dedicated to mythical animals. And I've got my own unicorn, as I mentioned, and my phoenix. So I would love to follow that up more and do some more interviews. I would actually love to go and interview tattoo artists. So the guy that did my tattoos, he's done a couple of similar tattoos. And I think it'd be really cool to yeah, talk to tattoo artists about the that side of the process. And I saw a, maybe I can put a link to her a video, but there's somebody in America who basically specializes in tattoos to companion animals. That's sort of her thing. And it'd be really cool to sort of follow somebody like that. And yeah, as I mentioned, the advocacy, the animal advocate tattoos, I think there's a lot of those about, and increasing number too of activist tattoos, so animal activist tattoos, and how people relate to the tattoos, how they kind of function as a conversation opener. I just love to talk to more people too. And I think there's definitely room for a quantitative study there. So some of the themes that emerge from the companion animal paper, and certainly from the second paper where people had tattoos representing a species, I think that there's room for a sort of bigger quantitative study there. Probably got a bunch of other ideas too. Whenever I talk to people about it, they're like, oh, you should do this and this. And
I was just thinking about researchers, how many researchers would have tattoos of their other than human research participants. But then I was thinking that would almost seem wrong unless you also tattoo your human. Since we do human other than human relationships, you would have to then, you would have to fairly represent both species, right? So then you would have to also have a human. So I wonder if anybody's ever done that. All I know is that the students very much enjoy reading these tattoo narrative papers. I think even the students that don't have experience with tattoos themselves find it fascinating in that it's more, I think, current and relatable to them. So I really appreciate your having composed these papers, because they're a great discussion starter with my students. And I think it just makes the whole concept of anthrozoology much more approachable.
Thanks. Thanks, Michelle. And yeah, it would be awesome if you, Michelle, would come on and share your research with your elephants in Nepal. And yeah, Sarah has a really cool research project on shark-human interactions.
Well, thank you for joining us for this episode of the Anthrozoology Podcast, where we discussed Dr. Chris Hill's tattoo narratives. We'll see you next time on the Anthrozoology Podcast.